North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the US and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The US is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the US says is a war on terror.
The so-called war on terror was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plan to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching the publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media, it's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump hasn't been interviewed on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News for more than 100 days, and other Republicans often get the attention that Donald Trump once received. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Fox News, Once Home to Trump, Now Often Ignores Him. It has been more than 100 days since Donald Trump was interviewed on Fox News. The network, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch and boosted Mr. Trump's ascension from real estate developer and reality television star to the White House, is now often bypassing him in favor of showcasing other Republicans. In the former president's view, according to two people who have spoken to him recently, Fox News' ignoring him is an affront far worse than running stories and commentary that he has complained are too negative. The network is effectively displacing him from his favorite spot, the center of the news cycle. On 22nd of July, as Donald Trump was rallying supporters in Arizona and teasing the possibility of running for president in 2024, saying, "We may have to do it again," Fox News chose not to show the event. The same approach it has taken for nearly all of his rallies this year. Instead, the network aired Laura Ingraham's interview with a possible rival for the 2024 Republican nomination, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. It was the first of two primetime interviews that Fox News Channel aired with Ron DeSantis in the span of 5 days. He appeared on Tucker Carlson's show shortly after talking to Laura Ingraham. When Donald Trump spoke to a gathering of conservatives in Washington this week, Fox News did not air the speech. It instead showed a few clips after he was done speaking. That same day, it did broadcast live, for 17 minutes, a speech by former Vice President Mike Pence. Donald Trump has complained recently to aides that even Sean Hannity, his friend of 20 years, doesn't seem to be paying him much attention anymore, one person who spoke to him recalled. The snubs are not coincidental, according to several people close to Rupert Murdoch's Fox Corporation, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the company's operations. This month, the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, both of them owned by Rupert Murdoch, published blistering editorials about Donald Trump's actions concerning the 6th of January 2021 riot on the Capitol. The skepticism towards Donald Trump extends to the highest levels of the company, according to two people with knowledge of the thinking of Rupert Murdoch, the chairman, and his son, Lachlan Murdoch, the chief executive. It also reflects concerns that Republicans in Washington, like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, have expressed to the Murdochs about the potential harm that Donald Trump could cause to the Republican Party's chances in the upcoming elections, especially its odds of taking control of the Senate. The Murdochs' discomfort with Donald Trump stems from his refusal to accept his election loss, according to two people familiar with those conversations, and is generally in sync with the views of Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who mostly supported the former president, but long ago said the election was settled and condemned Donald Trump's efforts to overturn it. One person familiar with the Murdochs' thinking said they remained insistent that Fox News had made the right call when its decision desk projected that Joseph R. Biden would win Arizona just after 11 p.m. on the night of the election, a move that infuriated Donald Trump and short-circuited his attempt to prematurely declare victory. This person said Lachlan Murdoch had privately described the decision desk call, which came days before other networks concluded that Donald Trump had lost the state of Arizona, as something only that Fox had the courage and science to do. Some of the people acknowledged that Fox's current approach to Mr. Trump could be temporary. If Donald Trump announces he's running for president or he's indicted, he will warrant more coverage, they said. A spokesman for Mitch McConnell declined to comment. A spokesman for the Fox Corporation also declined to comment, as did a spokeswoman for Donald Trump. The relationship between Donald Trump and the Murdoch media empire has long been complicated. An arrangement of mutual convenience and mistrust that has had sensational ups and downs since Donald Trump first talked himself onto the gossip pages of the New York Post in the 1980s. But the spat between the former president and the media baron, who has helped set the Republican Party's agenda for decades, is occurring in a much larger and more fragmented media landscape, as new personalities and platforms make it much harder for any one outlet to change the narrative. Donald Trump's allies in the corners of the conservative media that are more loyal to him, including Breitbart, Newsmax, and Talk Radio, are already seizing on the turn inside Fox News as evidence of a betrayal. Donald Trump appears willing to fight. He blasted Fox and Friends this week on his social media service, Truth Social, for being terrible and having gone to the dark side after one of his hosts had mentioned that Ron DeSantis had beat Donald Trump in two recent opinion polls of a hypothetical 2024 Republican primary contest. Then, offering no evidence, he blamed Paul Ryan, the former Republican Speaker of the House, with whom he often clashed. Paul Ryan sits on the Fox Corporation's board of directors. The New York Post was often on Mr. Trump's side in its editorials when he was president, but it occasionally went against him, like when Donald Trump refused to concede the election in 2020 and the paper's front page headlines blared, "Mr. President, stop this insanity." Donald Trump found a home on Fox News when the network's founder, Roger Ailes, gave him a weekly slot on Fox and Friends in 2011. Mr. Trump used the platform to connect with the budding Tea Party movement as he thrashed establishment Republicans like Paul Ryan and spread a lie about the authenticity of President Barack Obama's birth certificate. Initially, neither Roger Ailes nor Rupert Murdoch thought of Donald Trump as a serious presidential candidate. Roger Ailes told colleagues at the time that he thought Donald Trump was using his 2016 campaign to get a better deal with NBC, which broadcast The Apprentice, according to Insurgency, this reporter's account of Mr. Trump's rise in the GOP. And when Ivanka Trump told Rupert Murdoch over lunch in 2015 that her father intended to run for president, Rupert Murdoch reportedly did not even look up from his soup, according to The Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green. But as Mr. Trump became bigger than any one news outlet and bigger than even his own political party, he was able to turn the tables and rally his supporters against Fox News or any other outlet he felt was too critical of him. He regularly used Twitter to attack Fox personalities like Megyn Kelly, Charles Krauthammer, and Karl Rove. The network could always be critical of him in its news coverage, but now the skepticism comes through louder. In asides from news anchors, in interviews with voters, or in opinion articles for other Murdoch-owned media properties. Referring to the congressional investigation into the 6th of January attack, the Fox anchor Brett Baier said it had made Donald Trump look horrific by detailing how it had taken 187 minutes for him to be persuaded to say anything publicly about the riot. One recent segment on FoxNews.com featured interviews with Trump supporters who were overwhelmingly unenthusiastic about a possible third campaign, saying that they thought his time has passed and that he was a little too polarizing. Then they offered their thoughts on who should replace Donald Trump on the ticket. Unanimously, they named Ron DeSantis. "I spent 11 years at Fox and I know nothing. Pre-taped hits the Fox screen that hasn't been signed off on and sanctioned at the very top levels of management," said Eric Bolling, a former Fox News host who is now with Newsmax, especially when it has to do with a presidential election. "There can be no denying that Fox News remains Fox News. Viewers in recent weeks have seen occasionally critical coverage of Donald Trump. But unlike other news networks, Fox has chosen to air its own primetime programming rather than the hearings of the committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol." Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham dismissed the hearings as a show trial. "They are lying, and we are not going to help them do it," Tucker Carlson has said. "What we will do instead is to try to tell you the truth." The network has aired the January 6th committee hearings during the day when far fewer viewers are tuning in. But other segments during the daytime and even evening play up violent crime in Democratic-run cities or Joe Biden's verbal and physical stumbles. As the government announced that a key indicator of economic health declined last quarter, the headline Fox scrawled across the screen read, "Biden denies recession as U.S. enters recession." On 13th of April this year, Donald Trump called into Sean Hannity's show and ran through a list of crises he claimed would not be happening had we won this election, which we did. He hasn't been interviewed on the Fox News Network ever since.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards patience and fortitude. The one who has eloquently said, "Be aware that all good works bear praise, and they bear commendation and bring about a good reward." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues.
Every clean song and display.
Imam al-Hussein's first speech on the day of Ashura. O servants of Allah, fear Allah and be wary of the worldly life. For if the world had been eternal, or anybody had been destined to live forever, the prophets would have been the most worthy of survival and the most content with the divine destiny. However, Allah created the world for extinction. Hence, its new makes are antiquated, its graces are fleeting, its delight is sullen. Its situation is located on a mountain slope, and its house is transient. Hence, try to avail yourselves of some provisions, for the best of provisions is piety. And fear Allah, so that you may reach felicity. O people, Allah the Exalted created the world and has made it an abode of devastation and abasement that changes its inhabitants from one state to another. Hence, the deceived person is one who has been fooled by the world, and the evildoer is one whom it has deceived. Therefore, be wary not to be deceived by this world, for it shatters the hopes of anybody who has tended to it, and makes hopeless anybody who has had a hope in it.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائي عليك.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of Ziyara al-Nahiya al-Muqaddasa. Stay tuned.
وبقي الليل والنهار.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام على الحسين الذي سمحت نفسه بمهجته.
Peace be upon al-Husayn, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
السلام على من أطاع الله في سره وعلانيته.
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
السلام على من جعل الله الشفاء في تربته.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
السلام على من الإجابة تحت قبته.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
السلام على من الأئمة من ذريته.
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the imams after him.
السلام على ابن خاتم الأنبياء. السلام على ابن سيد الأوصياء.
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
السلام على ابن فاطمة الزهراء. السلام على ابن خديجة الكبرى.
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
السلام على ابن سدرة المنتهى. السلام على ابن جنة المأوى. السلام على ابن زمزم والصفا.
Peace be upon the son of the lotus tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the garden of refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
السلام على المرمل بالدماء. السلام على المهتوك الخباء. السلام على خامس أصحاب أهل الكسايا.
Peace be upon him who was saturated in his blood. Peace be upon him whose tents were violated. Peace be upon the fifth of the people of the cloak.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa bihi nasta'in. Sallallahu alayki wa abdillah, assalamu alayki wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is an episode of the program The Dialect, and I'm Dr. Fakhr al-Ruhani. As indicated earlier, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam gave several speeches and several talks on the day of Ashura for the enemy soldiers. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam understood that the enemy soldiers were short of appreciating the truth of his movement, then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam changed his mode of addressing them. He addressed them in a way that he rebuked them in order to awake them, in order to make them get to the senses. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated to them that what were the reasons for opposing him, for surrounding him. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam approached them, addressed them in such a way that they had surrounded him, it was all because they enjoyed this worldly life quite excessively, and they had haram food, haram meals, and all of these intentions, I mean all of these unfavorable, religiously unfavorable practices influenced the intellect and made them blind to the beauty and nicety of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In fact, we find that in the speeches of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he made frequent references to satanic temptations and wanted to awake the enemy soldiers that the surrounding him meant nothing but obeying Satan. And then we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated it to them that the illegitimate son of the illegitimate, that is, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, who was the governor of Kufa, had suppressed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, had exerted a very, very heavy pressure on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, so as to make him accept the proposal to recognize Yazid. However, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam wasn't such a person to admit such kind of abasement. And then he answered them, I mean the enemy forces, and indicated that he was steadfast in his divine way. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdin.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always. عليك مني
In the limelight.
In the years following the 11th of September 2001, anti-Muslim sentiments has grown in the United States. Studies showed from 2001 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States increased by 500%. According to experts, former US President Donald Trump's approach against Muslims is an example of an unprecedented anti-Islamic government in America. But what is currently worrying is that manifestation of Islamophobia has not decreased in the administration of current President Joe Biden. We will now take a look at the world media's coverage of this subject. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera's website writes, "The Muslim population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in the years following the suspicious 9/11 attacks, which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims. On the 21st anniversary of the attacks on Sunday, 11th of September, the executive director of the Los Angeles chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, Hossam Ailush, said that Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence. Hossam Ailush added, "Muslims continue to be the target of hate, bullying and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes and the media in the years following the 9/11 attacks." According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims skyrocketed immediately after the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and are still on an upward trend. Hossam Ailush said, The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry, and war. Eidouche further said that the statistics were not surprising considering the current volatile political climate in the United States, perpetuated by former President Donald Trump during his term in office, adding, "Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot. He made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim." Upon taking office in January of 2017, Donald Trump signed an executive order that banned travel to the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Citing the Muslim ban, Eidouche said, "Although the current administration overturned that ban, we're still dealing with the ramifications of it to this day, with many families still being separated." Hossam Eidouche noted that the U.S. has a long history of dehumanizing and marginalizing ethnic and religious groups, including Native Americans, African Americans, and Asian Americans. The Hill, an American newspaper based in Washington, D.C., explains more about this story. Since the 11th of September 2001 attacks, Muslims living in the United States have experienced political and cultural firsts, along with an exponential rise in hate crimes, bullying, harassment, and racial profiling. In the years following the 9/11 attacks, anti-Muslim sentiments grew in the United States. Data from Brown University revealed from 2000 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims spiked 500%. Beyond former President Barack Obama's presidency, critics contend that former President Donald Trump's policies exhibited animosity towards the community, such as his Muslim travel ban, which included predominantly Muslim countries. In 2020, the Justice Department found there were 110 anti-Muslim incidents in the United States. The Department of Justice also found that religion was the second most common reason for single bias incidents in the United States. A Pew Research survey found U.S. Republicans increasingly associated Muslims with Islam and violence, with 72% of Republicans in 2021 believing Islam was more likely than other religions to encourage violence. Among Democrats, 32% felt the same. Abdullah Hamoud, the first Muslim American mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, told Changing America that there was a sense of urgency among members of the Muslim American community to step up and push back against Islamophobia in a post-9/11 America. Before becoming mayor of Dearborn, Hamoud ran for a seat in Michigan's state legislature. He shared that doors were slammed in his face when he introduced himself. Representatives Rashiba Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, became the first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. The Progressive Squad members are two of the most prominent Muslim voices in American politics, elected in the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections during the Trump administration. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have previously shared that they've received violent threats during their time in U.S. Congress. The Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. Commemorations for the 9/11-2001 events remain an important part of U.S. history, but for Muslim Americans, post-9/11 ramifications of Islamophobia have bled deep into the fabric of American society more than two decades later. As a result, 21 years after the suspicious attacks, Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence and are working to amplify narratives about Muslims that are authentic and accurate to counter the spread of misinformation. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes immediately against Muslims skyrocketed after the 9/11 attacks, rising 1.61% from 2000 to 2001, marking some of the highest hate numbers of Islamophobic hate crimes ever seen in America. Referring to an August 2022 study, Zahra Jamal, Associate Director of Rice University's Bonnyuk Institute for Religious Tolerance in Houston, Texas, said, 62% of Muslims report feeling religion-based hostility from others, and 65% have felt disrespected. That's almost three times the percentage among Christians. She said, Muslims in the United States also reported that they have been threatened with physical violence, chased or followed, or had their home vandalized due to their religion. They also have higher rates of experiencing physical assault or property damage due to their religion. According to Zahra Jamal, just over 80% of Muslims reported that others assumed things about them due to their religion, while 21% of Muslim adults reported police harassment. She said the numbers related to discrimination against Muslims are alarming and show just how much Islamophobia has increased in the United States over the past several years. Zahra Jamal added, for Muslims, scores on the Islamophobia Index have increased from 18 in 2018 to 26 in 2022.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to Allah. Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master Prophet Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. The report we listened to from Mr. Raisi, the Honorable President, and also the rest of the gentlemen whom we have listened to, have been very beneficial. Let us remember our dear martyrs, Martyr Rajai and Martyr Bahonar. These two men were truly and honestly two equal leaders of the Islamic Revolution. Both of them, well, I worked alongside both of them for many years, especially Mr. Bahonar. I knew them and saw them up close in person. The Almighty Allah rewarded them with martyrdom. It would have been truly a pity if these people had died in deaths other than martyrdom. Let us remember them.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Government Week has two functions, one of which is often neglected. I shall talk about both of these functions. The first function of Government Week is the issue of remembering, like remembering Martyr Rajai and Martyr Bahonar, and remembering the event that took place during the revolution. Remembering stands opposite to neglect. It stands opposite to forgetfulness, which in itself is a great disease. Negligence and forgetfulness are great diseases. You can only warn people who follow the remember. You can only warn someone who follows the reminder, the Quran in verse 11, chapter 36. Reminder is the word of dhikr. We have sent down to you a book in which there is an admonition for you. A chapter in the Quran, chapter 21, verse 10. One of the most important issues that religion pursues is the creating awareness in people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will, to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967. So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance. But for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing, with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis, I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Pourreza, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food.
As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some